As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
I started as a teenager getting interested in radio and Chinese, and that took me to China in 1989. December 1989, 6 months after Tiananmen Square, as an 18-year-old. And it was really a treat for me to be there, to see China as a country that was poorer than most African countries. This was a time in China when there were still food rations, when Mondays was rice, Tuesdays was oil and whatnot. Many of the hutongs in Beijing did not have indoor plumbing. I mean, it was still very, very old and very poor. Not a lot of color back then. And the point here is that to see what China has done from that moment to today, to go to the second largest economy in the world, has been really just an amazing trajectory.
Aloha and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel of the United States Army, retired, and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 45, China and the Indo-Pacific South. Today we tackle a topic too sprawling for a single conversation, yet it's too urgent to delay. China's expanding footprint in the global south, especially across the Indo-Pacific's developing states. From ports and railways to data cables and TikTok feeds, Beijing's presence is reshaping trade routes, information flows, and political calculations. For capitals from Jakarta to Suva, the question is no longer whether Chinese engagement matters, but how to harvest its benefits without surrendering strategic leverage. The term Global South encompasses a remarkably diverse group, economically, politically, and historically. What binds these nations is a shared pursuit of growth, strategic autonomy, and dignity in a global system long skewed toward others' priorities. And nowhere is that pursuit more vivid than here in the Indo-Pacific, where frontline states must navigate infrastructure gaps, environmental shocks, and rising great power rivalry, often all at once. China has positioned itself as an indispensable partner under the Belt and Road Initiative. It has financed deep water ports in Pakistan, rail lines in Laos, and power plants from Cambodia to Papua New Guinea. In the digital sphere, it exports not just hardware, but entire ecosystems. Huawei's 5G switches, WeChat Pay wallets, and TikTok's viral narratives, bundled with promises of affordability and connectivity. Add to this a polished diplomatic message of South-South solidarity, and Beijing increasingly casts itself as a builder, a banker, and big brother, all rolled into one. But the sheen is wearing thin. A debt crisis in Sri Lanka, protests over surveillance tech in the Solomon Islands, and youth-driven backlash in Malaysia. These remind us that China's embrace is far from uniform and it's rarely unconditional. So the question becomes, are we seeing the rise of a new dependency or the maturation of global South statecraft, where smaller powers learn to hedge, bargain, and say no? In this episode, we'll explore eight interconnected themes, from the reinvention of the Belt and Road to rise of digital influence to the quiet resilience of middle powers refusing to be trapped in someone else's rivalry. And through it all, we'll follow one central thread. What does China truly seek in the Indo-Pacific South? And how are partner states redefining their own agency in response? To unpack these dynamics, I'm joined by Eric Olander, CEO of the China Global South Project, and one of the sharpest voices documenting China's engagement with the developing world. Eric brings years of on-the-ground reporting and deep analytical insights with a lens that spans Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific. Eric Olander, welcome to Dialogue.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
We have been so blessed by having you here at the center this week. We brought you in for the China track that's going on, China in the world, and your expertise. I've had an opportunity to listen to you, and thank you for being here.
It's been wonderful. The conversations have been great, and what a great team you've got here.
I appreciate that.
I wonder if we might start with you just telling us about yourself. You've got rich experience here, but paint that for us.
Yeah, so I started as a teenager getting interested in radio and Chinese. And that took me to China in 1989, in December 1989, 6 months after Tianemen Square, as an 18-year-old. And it was really a treat for me to be there to see China as a country that was poorer than most African countries were. This was a time in China when there were still food rations, when Mondays was rice, Tuesdays was oil and whatnot. Many of the hutongs in Beijing did not have indoor plumbing. It was still very, very old and very poor. Not a lot of color back then. And the point here is that to see what China has done in from that moment to today, to go to the second largest economy in the world, has been really just an amazing trajectory. So then I got into journalism, and I worked for the alphabet soup of news networks, CNN, CNBC, Associated Press.
All
I was an AP correspondent in Beijing. I was CNN in Hong Kong, BBC World Service. Wow. And my passion was journalism in China. And just China is the puzzle that can never be solved. There's just constant moving pieces. And for me, it was just an unending challenge. But then in the mid-2000s, my brother moved to Africa, and he said, why don't you come out and see me in Congo? So I went out to Kinshasa, and there was one Chinese restaurant in Kinshasa. And it just proves that there's a Chinese restaurant literally in every major city in the world. I went back in 2006 and 7, and there were two Chinese restaurants, nothing big. But by 7, 8, and 9, and around that 2008 period, it just went boom. I mean, there were Chinese everywhere. There was Chinese signs, there was Huawei, there was Chinese construction, there were Chinese people, Chinese markets, out of nowhere. And it was one of these things where it was just a phenomena that was happening, but you didn't understand in the moment what it was. And this was really the reflection of China's going out policy, and they really, and this is again the precursor to the Belt and Road, where they were, and they looked out into the world. They were already in Southeast Asia through large diaspora networks. South America was too far, too exotic. The G7 countries were regulatory barriers too high to enter, too complex, too expensive. But there was Africa, where the United States had largely disengaged after the Cold War. Europe largely disengaged, just saw it as a pitiful place of war and famine and disease and immigration. They weren't really engaged. And Africans looked to the Chinese and said, we are tired of aid. We want trade. And the Chinese turned around and said, great, we don't do aid, we do trade. Okay. And so there was this surge of engagement in Africa, and I was right there at that very beginning. I moved to Kinshasa in 2010 to run my brother's company. And at the time I asked my employees, because I said, what do you think of the Chinese here? And at that time I was having a difficult time how to frame it. I'm reading the New York Times, I'm reading the Guardian, the Wall Street Journal, traditional Western media and Western press, and the narratives about the Chinese in Africa were China's colonizing Africa, China's conquering Africa. It's the neocolonial narrative, extractive, abusive. Right. And then you read the Chinese media and it's win-win and everybody's great and this is the most wonderful thing. So I was having a difficult time reconciling it. And I asked my employees, I said, what do you guys think? They kind of sat back, they laughed about the question, and then they gave me these very long, textured, nuanced, complicated answers. I like this, but I don't like this. And I remember that moment clearly because I said, that is the story.
Yeah.
It's not the binary, China's bad, China's good. It's the complexity of it. So in your introduction, you laid it out perfectly. There are many, many pros for Southeast Asia and Indo-Pacific for engaging with China. At the same time, there are also lots of risks as well. What we do at the China Global South Project is we explore that middle space, the nuance, the risks and the rewards of Chinese engagement.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, that is the exact reason why I've been listening to you and your colleagues for many years.
Wonderful.
Is because, of course, I read and listen to a span of voices, but you very much still get the narrative that you described about being exploitative and stuff, and so, but the story is much more than that,
right?
And so, you bring that to this field, and we I am better off.
Well, we're very grateful. And one of the things we like to do on the show is to put people in front of you who you would not ordinarily cross paths with. So too often the discourse about China is anchored in Washington, anchored in Brussels and London through think tanks and universities and whatnot, in a very Western lens. What we want to do is bring, Southeast Asian scholars, analysts, and practitioners, African, South American, and to bring those voices that are usually overlooked in this discourse, but yet now carry an importance in the discourse about China that can't be overstated, given the fact that China is so engaged in their countries, and we don't understand that always.
I think I do. I listen to your show all the time, read your newsletters. I mean, to double down on what you said, you've just recently had a voice in there speaking on Somaliland.
Yeah.
And you had one very recently, a series on EVs.
That's
and
right.
You had on anti-alignment movement in
exactly.
India. I mean, so you are really spread in helping us think about
and to think about it again.
Please.
We want to challenge some of the conventional wisdom
and
we've heard in some of the discussions this week here that one militarizes the relationship and sees it primarily through a security lens.
Yes.
That's a hazard for the United
it
States
is.
Because the world sees security as very important, but not everything.
Yeah.
And at the same time, to try and see it from the point of view of others. And I think for Americans, that's a very difficult challenge. We've never been forced to do that in the modern era. We've always seen it through our lens, and because we've been at the apex of power, we've gotten away with that. But today we're competing. I always like to say that, the end of the Cold War, really a malaise settled into U.S. national security thinking. We thought that the battle of ideas was over.
Yes.
We won, the Soviets lost. It was
the end of history,
and that was it. And we forgot that the challenge with China is a battle of ideas, first and foremost. And I feel that people, on this side of the Pacific don't always fully understand that and appreciate it.
No.
So we try and bring some of these ideas into their radar and their sphere of thinking.
I want to pull on all of this now. And so your show, China Global South, your project there, let's define the global South.
It's a terrible word.
Right?
It's a terrible word. We're talking, more than 150 countries that have very little in common. There's no, common thread other than a colonial struggle. But the United States was a former colony as well of the British Empire.
Okay.
So that by itself can't be the uniting factor. Some people will say, it's the lack of access to the system is what unites them. But then Singapore, for example, there is no consistency here.
Right.
We chose Global South in part because that's how many countries refer to themselves. So if you go to a place like Indonesia, they talk about South-South. They talk about the Global South. China refers to the Global South. Some people will say the Global Majority. But we settled on the South only because it is a term that they use oftentimes to describe themselves, and we felt it was the most applicable.
Yeah,
in the context.
It's a term that has been used for many decades.
It is, but it is an imperfect term.
It is. Third world.
Third
was
world
the,
again.
Previous term. In
previous
the 70s,
term.
60s.
But that was really in a Cold War context.
It was, wasn't it?
So it doesn't apply in the current era. And nothing really rolls off the tongue. There's a little bit of marketing that's involved, too. But Global South, I like in part because, again, first and foremost, a lot of these countries are comfortable with that language. And so it's not a kind of Western definition of this region. It's often how they describe themselves.
No, you're spot on. So I want to pull on, and you spoke a lot about the Belt and Road and the redux going on. You did a show on Small and Beautiful and stuff. And so it is changing. There's an evolution of genuine. Is this evolution that's going on? Is it genuine or is it in fact?
Oh no, it's genuine.
Say more.
It's big. I mean, so the Belt and Road is now going into its second decade.
Yeah.
This thing launches
from 2013.
From 2013, and so we're now. It launched in 2013. It just spikes up into 2016, and 2016 is the peak, and that's where we have the port of Ambandota in Sri Lanka, that's where we get the standard gauge railway in Kenya, this orgy of spending.
Right.
It reminded me after 9/11, when we then embarked on the global war on terror. And it was just the same kind of spike up. And you basically, in Washington, if you said, I'm fighting Al-Qaeda, they double your budget. I'm fighting ISIS, they double your budget. In China, it was, oh, this is a BRI project. Bam, you get more money. You know, so this thing just, and China was flush with cash. It was eager to kind of get out there to do something, to put this money to work. But by their own admission, they didn't have the oversight to manage the process. So by 2016, Xi Jinping launches his anti-corruption internal police to start cracking down on this thing. Now, you know, a lot of people will denigrate the Belt and Road for, you know, wasteful spending and things like that. But for a government as large as China to make a course correction 36 months into a major policy initiative, I don't think we would be able to do that that quickly. So I give them some credit on that. 2015, the spending starts to go down. If you look at the charts, it's just, it's a peak in 16, 15, and then by 17, you're on this chart all the way down. A couple things start to happen. One is lenders, you know, start to be much more demanding for better feasibility, better due diligence on the projects that they're lending to. So the port of Hambantota was just a completely idiotic project. The Rajapaksa family wanted to put things there. There was no economic sense to putting things there. You know, the Chinese said, are you sure you want to put a port here right so close to the port of Colombo? They go, yep, we want to put it there. It was a boneheaded idea. Both the Chinese and the Sri Lankans are to blame for this fiasco.
Yeah, so as a result, I'm going to just stop there for a second. So you've got Colombo right here. That's the normal traffic going that direction. They had to redirect down here to come to Hambantota.
And they put a big airport there. They put big highways there.
Yeah,
no reasonable reason, no population density there. And the Chinese will admit themselves that this was a boondoggle.
Yeah.
And the mistelling of the story, though, is that the debt problems in Sri Lanka were due to the Chinese loans related to this. The Sri Lankan data is absolutely clear on this, that it was Eurobond debt that they fell behind on, and that China itself was not the largest lender in Sri Lanka, that when you look at it's Japan, China, and India, all three compete as the Chinese, as Sri Lankan's largest creditors.
Yeah.
But the Chinese recognized this was a boondoggle. When the time came for the Sri Lanka to say, listen, we're not going to be able to repay this, a lot of the Chinese creditors said, listen, we don't want this thing back. You bought it, you own it. They ended up on the 99-year lease after a whole period of negotiations. But one of the things we try and do is debunk some of these myths that, again, this is an example of debt trap diplomacy. We have Sri Lankan scholars who went to the Ministry of Finance, who knocked on the doors of the Ministry of Finance, said, can we see the loan papers? Sure enough, the Ministry of Finance gave them the loan papers. And so we talked to these scholars, and they kind of lay it out very clearly as to that it was Eurobond debt, not the Chinese debt. And so, again, that's part of what we want to do is introduce that kind of nuance in some of these discourses.
I mean, let's pull on a little bit further
on
this debt dilemma you're speaking about.
I
mean, are Indo-Pacific states, I mean, are they finding ways that they can actually pursue their developmental needs without falling into the dependency? I mean, that's a hard thing, right? Actually, hey, I need help, I need money, and yet you can...
So be careful with that word dependency, because the nature of a developing country is you're always dependent.
You are.
Whether you're dependent on China, or you're dependent on Europe, or you're dependent on the US, there is a dependency built into it. We can talk about security dependency right now. The Philippines, 100% dependent on the United States for security.
Yes.
The Philippine situation would be very different if it didn't have the United States. So dependency for developing countries is an inherent characteristic. The question is, as you pointed out in your introduction, can you manage it?
Yes.
Is there a balance in it? The problem for poor developing countries is access to capital. How do you build that infrastructure without building on too much debt? Now, in Cambodia, we see the Sihanouk Expressway, which is built by the China Road and Bridge Corporation, a public-private partnership, not much debt. In Laos, we see a $6 billion railway that is consuming the budget, huge amounts of debt. So it varies quite a bit, but there's not a lot of choices for many of these governments in terms of accessing capital. So the Chinese will come in almost as a lender of last resort. The World Bank got out of the big infrastructure financing in 20, 30 years ago. They don't finance these big projects.
Right.
The U.S. and Europe don't do that, even though they say they want to compete with the Belt and Road. And so in many respects, to build this large infrastructure, there was only China. Now today, with the exception of Southeast Asia, China's out of that game as well, too, for two reasons. One, China doesn't have the money that it had 10, 15 years ago. The Chinese economy is not really doing very well. Also, public opinion in China, just like public opinion here, doesn't really like the idea of why am I spending money on that guy when my school down the street and my school buses are terrible. So public opinion does matter in China to some extent. And Xi recognizes that. And we know this because they will censor a lot of the big ticket announcements about, you know, development finance projects. Those get kind of wiped out of the discourse in China. And so we have this situation now where China's financing connectivity, it's financing solar, it's financing EV. These are smaller scale, both because of the debt sustainability problems on the borrower side, but also because on the creditor side, they don't have as much money.
You know, so let's pull on this.
Yeah.
I want to pull on, you know, this strategic resource control. China is securing key assets, right?
Sure.
Energy, fisheries, minerals from Southeast Asia, South Pacific. What are the risks and trade-offs when Beijing controls critical input and strategic gateways?
Control is an interesting word.
Okay.
Because in many respects, the Chinese don't have full control. I mean, you look at a country like Vietnam, has a lot of agency in its management of its ties with China and a lot of sensitivities. Now, the Chinese, particularly in fishing, operate large gray zone tactics, both in terms of their security, but also in terms of actual illegal fishing, is a big problem in the South Pacific. It's a big problem in off the coast of Africa and elsewhere. There's not much that a lot of these developing countries can do without the support of international bodies or without the support of foreign governments who help them with satellite monitoring technologies. And the United States, particularly in South Asia and in the South Pacific, has put that as a major priority, is to fund the ability to track illegal Chinese fishing. That's very important. But in terms of controlling resources, I think that's overstated oftentimes, in part because in a place, again, like Southeast Asia, you have a diversity of actors who are there. The Chinese are by no means alone. The South Koreans are very active. The Japanese are very active. The Americans are also present. Let's not forget that in Southeast Asia, that U.S. FDI is more than double that of the Chinese. So it's very easy for us to overstate China's presence, particularly in resource extraction, when in fact U.S. mining companies like Freeport-McMoRan very active in Indonesia as well. China and Indonesia is very interesting, particularly in the nickel sector.
Say more.
They dominate the smelting side of things. So the latest data that we've seen is about 75% of Indonesia's nickel sector, it touches the Chinese, if you will, at some point in the supply chain. That's made it very difficult under the Inflation Reduction Act for U.S. companies to qualify to not have any of their materials touch Chinese supply chains. Now, though, the Inflation Reduction Act looks like it's sunsetting, so that's going to make it much easier for U.S. companies to be able to tap into products that may have touched the Chinese supply chains. But I think Indonesia is a good example where there is a little bit of concern that the Chinese have too much of a role in the nickel sector, much the same way that in the Democratic Republic of Congo, 80% of the cobalt coming out of there is controlled at some level by the Chinese as well. What the Congolese and the Indonesians will tell you, they don't like being in this position. They would rather have a diversity of actors in their market. The problem has been, it's very difficult to get European, Japanese, and American companies to go to places like the Congo and to go to places like Indonesia to mine, in part because the Chinese now have such a strong presence there.
You know, it is the curse of being a small country where you can't sometimes get attention. And then if you, in this case, you've drawn attention, you've got some assistance, it comes with other strings and things, and yet then you're almost castigated for having made choices you were down to no choices anyhow,
that's
and you took the only choice coming. It is a real tough
I mean, that's the dynamic in Oceania, is that for a long time, the United States didn't even have diplomatic representation there.
Right.
These were countries that, you know, that Australia, you know, pushed off, that New Zealand pushed off, that the Americans pushed off. So they went to the Chinese. And all of a sudden, then, that makes everybody stand up. And how they engaged the Chinese, and the Chinese came into Oceania, you know, with their toolkit of, we're going to do development finance, we're going to provide security, you know, assistance, we're going to have cultural exchanges, they're going to put, you know, Confucius centers. They have a whole menu of things that they do and elsewhere around the world that they brought to Oceania. That then triggers a very strong response from Canberra, triggers all of a sudden the United States, and Kirk Campbell, you know, when he was in office, is running back and forth now to open up a new mission in Solomon Islands and to start kind of revving up. So in some ways, I think Oceania represents how countries are leveraging ties with China as a way to generate that kind of interest from the major powers to say, listen, if you're going to ignore us, we're going to go to somebody who won't. And that's now provoked quite a bit of concern now that the Pacific Island Forum, which used to have some type of unity and some type of cohesion to it, they oftentimes were very, very celebrated for voting as a bloc and the consensus-based decision-making. Sharp divisions now with the Pacific Island Forum, oftentimes, you know, provoked by China and the relations with China.
In 2016, I think when I got here, you could not draw attention towards the Pacific Island area. We were focus on other things. You say, oh, this is important. No, we're not interested. Of course, that shortly begins to change, as you just described. Today, there are three countries in the Pacific Islands that recognize Taiwan.
Yep.
Tuvalu, when they had elections here recently, came very close. Which way will this go? That would take them down to two. There's 12 worldwide. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to listen to you. You're talking about Somaliland. And
yeah.
The dynamics, of course, even before I listened to you speak on it yesterday, I had the opportunity to listen to, a few weeks ago on a podcast you did. But and I thought about this dynamic of playing China PRC off of Taiwan, trying to draw attention where there are a few levers. I wonder if you might.
So Somaliland's an interesting case here, and it speaks to how, again, in the Caribbean, also in Oceania, and then in this tiny breakaway piece of the Horn of Africa, Somaliland is breaking away from Somalia.
Yeah, 1991, I think,
right.
A breakaway.
And so they want to be an independent country. They go to China initially to say, hey, we'd like to engage with you. The Chinese go, uh-uh, this looks like Taiwan to us. We don't deal with breakaway regions. Because if they dealt with Somaliland, that would almost validate Taiwan, and like, can't do that. So Somaliland then kind of pivots and says, okay, we're going to try now to get international recognition from the United States, and they lean on to Taiwan. Yeah. So Taiwan opens a representative office in Hargeisa. The foreign ministers go back and forth, and all of a sudden there's this great kind of bond between Taiwan and Somaliland. Well, not surprisingly, this just infuriates China.
Yeah.
But speaking to these Somaliland political scientists who we spoke to on the show, one of the things that they revealed is fascinating how the thinking is not that there's going to be a long-term relationship between Somaliland and Taiwan, but that once you secure U.S. recognition, once you get recognition from Gulf countries, then you can go to the Chinese and say, listen, we'll use Taiwan as a bargaining chip. We'll cashier our relationship with Taiwan in exchange for something with you. That would then be considered a win for China, that they're, and it's a little bit like how Trump does things. You know, Trump will put a tariff up really high, higher than anybody could imagine, come down to a point
people
that's halfway, and they think that's progress. But it is an interesting negotiating tactic.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to work at the end of the day, because what people don't understand about Taiwan for China is it is their Jerusalem.
Yeah.
They're just not going to compromise on it in any way. So I think Somaliland's going down a pretty lonely path here, but In Oceania, the Chinese are going to put the pressure on to try and flip the remaining countries. But Palau and Marshall Islands, they're never going to go. I mean, they're too closely aligned with the United States.
Yeah, no, I mean, these are two of the three COFA states
that draw
heavily upon the U.S. The U.S. has deep influence.
They're just not going to go.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no. Well, thanks for pulling on that and thinking about that. We spoke a little bit about this digital influence push. And China, you know, Huawei, TikTok, data centers. I mean, they...
E-commerce.
Oh, my goodness. E-commerce, right?
E-commerce.
Yeah.
Huge. I mean, in Southeast Asia. So I live in Southeast Asia. And it used to be 10 years ago when e-commerce first came, you buy something on Lazada, which is Alibaba's e-commerce site. It takes 10 to 14 days something to come from China. Mm. Now, 24 hours.
Amazing.
I mean, and sometimes I can even get it same day.
Yeah.
And Cainiao, which is China's, which is Alibaba's logistic arm, is flying in daily flights into Ho Chi Minh City, Jingdong as well. They're flying, there's a network of flights. The e-commerce is just massive. What I don't understand, and no one's been able to explain to me, is why these countries are allowing so much Chinese e-commerce to come in and not tariffing it. Because it presents an existential threat to small and medium-sized enterprises. I am buying things that come directly from a distribution center in Guangxi province and that come right to my house and skip any local distribution. So there's no value being added by the local merchants. I don't understand why these countries aren't seeing that as a threat to their small businesses, but it's the way it is.
Of course, we're kind of getting into exploring some of this tariffing on those small purchases.
Right.
I mean, the United States going through the Postal Service and those have been had carve outs almost or weren't looked at here in the United States, and then they're like, nope, they're going to stop that. Or how do you tariff services? You know, it's been easier, I think, traditionally anyway, to tariff goods as they come across. I actually think we might be entering a new phase, and
people are
going to, I would assume, that they'll start looking at this.
It's difficult. Indonesia tried to put under $20 the tariffs on this, and it's been difficult, though, because there are a lot of people in the supply chain in Indonesia, for example, that do benefit from this, and they push back. South Africa, same way, tried to put kind of restrictions on shipments under $20. These are the Shein type of buying one dress, one blouse, and have it shipped in directly from China. It's harder to do than many people think. It requires a pretty robust infrastructure within your postal system. And this is why the Americans had their threshold at $800.
That's right.
They just did not want to have to kind of look through every package and see what's going on. Automation can probably help that now.
Yeah.
But it is something that I think we'll see. The end of Shein sending kind of cheap stuff may be in sight. Now, Shein is setting up big warehouses in Vietnam, so they want to get away around that. So the Chinese are quite enterprising when it comes to evolving and adapting around some of these new policies. I don't think we're seeing the end of Chinese influence on e-commerce or any of these tech, even though restrictions are coming up in face of them.
So let me then pull on this. We've kind of talked about this. So the question then is, how is this shaping political discourse, media ecosystem, cybersecurity across the Indo-Pacific societies? You talked one aspect of it. I just want to kind of pull you out on this other.
So in Southeast Asia, let's kind of focus there. The touch points of China in your daily life are too numerous to count, whether it's from e-commerce to increasingly cars now, to infrastructure, to technology. China increasingly is being bound and woven inseparably into the daily life, and not just in Southeast Asia, in Africa and other places. Mm. China's view on this is that if they can bind Southeast Asia into, you know, the Chinese economic orbit, then it will reduce the risk of these countries kind of turning against them. And so this is why we're seeing everywhere in the world, we've seen this drop in funding for BRI, for large-scale infrastructure, except Southeast Asia. Hmm. So there's a new $8 billion railway connecting the port of Haiphong in northern Vietnam to Guangxi province. Big numbers that we don't see anywhere else in the world. China wants to build a whole railway network throughout Southeast Asia so you can travel from Singapore right up into southern China by rail. That's their vision. And the idea is that you're physically and economically linking these regions. And let's not forget, and this was part of the distorted discourse here in the United States about when Xi was in Vietnam, you heard a lot of commentators on CNBC and other places saying, well, listen, you know, it's great that Xi is going around these poor countries in Southeast Asia, but really it's the American market that's the most important. China does twice as much trade with Southeast Asia as it does with the United States. Mm. $924 billion to about $500 billion. So economically, Southeast Asia is the front line for China. And we saw Prime Minister Li Qiang in Kuala Lumpur recently for the ASEAN summit. And you're seeing the sentiment coming from ASEAN leaders to China is very warm. They're very receptive to this. They resent the trade pressures that they're under from the United States. They do economically see their futures much more aligned with China than with other parts of the world.
Yeah, so earlier this month, I think May 3rd in Milan, ASEAN plus three financial ministers surprisingly put out a statement that kind of pushed back on all the pressures, economic pressures that the U.S. is kind of pushing.
That ASEAN plus three was very important because that was Japan, South Korea, and China.
Yep.
South Korea and Japan are U.S. allies. Yep. And so look at the growing prominence of ASEAN now. ASEAN GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council Summit that just took place. ASEAN plus three. ASEAN has, for a long time, been a feckless group.
Yeah.
The member states intentionally kept it weak.
Yeah.
That is starting to change. At the same time, China's influence on ASEAN remains quite significant. So the code of conduct for the South China Sea is something that is stalled and is really never going to probably get out of committee, in my view, in part because you don't have consensus within ASEAN on South China Sea issues, but you do have consensus within ASEAN on trade issues. And that's where you're going to see a lot of this push, and increasingly towards the United States. ASEAN, I don't want to say it's anti-American, but it's definitely frustrated with the Americans right now. They want more engagement, but even under the Biden administration, U.S. engagement with ASEAN was tepid at best. You know, with no preferential market access, with no kind of deep engagement, no presidential visits, they just felt that they were kind of being relegated to the side. So what do ASEAN countries do? They're looking to Europe, they're looking to South America, they're forming these big trade agreements, RCEP, TPP, and TPP is huge too.
Yeah.
I mean, remember the CPTPP, after the Americans left, everybody got together and said, let's keep going.
Yeah.
Now the Chinese want to get into CPTPP. That won't happen because the Australians said, that's just, you know, it's a consensus-based organization. Australia said it will not allow in. So, but nonetheless, the Chinese are trying.
Though one could argue that unlike RCEP, which doesn't have the same type of standards and structures CPTPP has, one can argue, and they do, you know, by bringing them in, you bring about change because they've got to conform to meet the criteria to be a part of that group.
I mean, it's just funny as an American, and I'm sure you probably look at this too, CPTPP accomplished so much of what Americans say they want to do today, to marginalize and isolate the Chinese, to build a coalition of countries that would have shared values on intellectual property, on trade, you know, so much. There were problems with it, to be sure.
Yeah.
But in terms of isolating China, CPTPP would have done quite a bit to do that. And so when the Americans pulled out, that was really a gift to China, no doubt.
Yeah, no, you know, if we were going to talk more on economics on this, you know, there's so much to pull on that, and how this just negatively just reverberates through society in America as they think about, you know, free trades and how, you know, the suck that happened after Clinton's free trade agreement.
Yeah. And just very quickly before I move on from ASEAN, remember, China and ASEAN have just completed their negotiations for the FTA 3.0, the Free Trade Area 3.0. So free trade, while unpopular in Europe and the U.S., more so here in the U.S., very popular in places like Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And so I think you're going to see more free trade, more, you know, engagement with other parts of the world. And the ultimate goal for a lot of these countries is to reduce their dependence on the United States so that the dependence is that key word there, they're not held hostage like they are today.
Yeah, no, thanks for pulling on that more, because I actually think that while we see this as something to be avoided, that's not the way it's being.
That's not how it's seen in other parts of the world.
Yeah. Let's talk about this South-South leadership.
Yeah.
Beijing casts itself as a champion of the global South.
Yep.
And though not all the partners view the relationship as equal, they in fact are having quite the headway, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
So how are Indo-Pacific states responding to China's positioning as a developmental and political leader?
Yeah, I think there's this idea of the leader of the global South. The Chinese oftentimes try to present themselves that way. Indonesia feels itself as where the Bandung movement started in 1955. It has some ownership over this leadership mantle. And India as well also likes to present itself as the paramount leader of the global south. So there's not a consensus as to...
That's right.
And I think most countries in the global south resent the idea that there is a leader. No one elected you to be our leader kind of thing.
So
this is something the bigger powers like to, you know, ascribe to themselves. Mm. That being said, one of the things we heard from Prabowo Subianto, the president of Indonesia, is there in his speech at the Indonesia-China business reception that took place last week with Prime Minister Li Qiang, was this gratitude and expression of appreciation for China for standing up for countries, and these are his words, that opposed apartheid, opposed oppression, opposed colonialism, and supported the Palestinian cause.
Oh, wow.
These are interesting choices of words. And one of the things that I think we undervalue and underappreciate in the global north is how colonialism and the trauma of colonialism is still very much a part of contemporary politics in Africa and in Southeast Asia and others. And so this idea of China's role as a, you know, from the 1960s and 1970s as, you know, Mao fighting the liberation movements in Southeast Asia and also in, you know, remember, you know, obviously the Vietnam War was, you know, China was instrumental in that. And then also in Africa and places like Angola, the Chinese there. And they bring that up now a lot because they see the struggles in many ways as reminiscent of those colonial struggles. So for, you know, Prabowo Subianto, what's happening in Israel and Gaza is a colonial war. Okay, that's their view. They are very articulate on this. That's not my interpretation of it. And the fact that he chose the word apartheid, I thought was so interesting because it speaks to the current difficulties that the United States and South Africa are having and the frustrations that people see with, you know, the crackdown on immigrants in the United States except Afrikaners. So these are being studied, these trends, by countries like Indonesia, and China's benefiting from them as well.
Yeah, no, I know you and your colleague Kobus have spoken about what's happening down there.
Yeah.
Obviously he's got a front row seat to it.
Huge.
In South Africa. Late 70s, had a classmate who was an exchange student from South Africa. It was my first exposure. You know, even when you were talking about, you know, going in the 80s into Africa and into China, I'm like, these are not popular destinations for the time. I mean, they became, but not, it felt like. And so I've been amazed at how you have been engaged for so long in these areas that you are able to pull this string through and see with clarity how these things are happening over time.
Well, yeah, and it's just, that's the benefit of doing this for so long, is that you can, when you're writing these stories every day, you say, you know, that feels familiar to something happened 3-4 years ago. And this is why when you're studying China today, you know, one of the things I talked about in the lecture here is that we have to stop thinking about, and this is endemic in the United States government, in the national security, and even in corporates as well.
Yeah.
I'm not part of the China team. That's Bob on the third floor. He's in the China team. Everybody's got to be part of the China team now. And our China literacy has to be more than just say, if you're in the security establishment, I only know about Chinese security and defense issues. I don't pay attention to economic, cultural, and political issues, and vice versa in the political side. You have to look at it holistically. Because and this is one of the reasons why we originally started as the China Africa Project.
Yes.
And then we eventually became the China Global South Project.
I remember when you said
that. Because we felt that looking at one continent and one region in isolation of the others was actually counterproductive. Because so much of what China is doing around the world is transversal, transnational. So when you look at debt, when you look at BRI, when you look at Huawei, now EVs, all of these trends are across regions. Mm. And so you can start drawing lessons about how did they restructure the debt in Ecuador with what they did in Laos, with what they're doing in Cambodia. You can start to draw lessons from those in connecting the dots. So that's the benefit for looking at this, again, as broad and wide as you possibly can, and not in these narrow silos, which I think is a problem in how we look at China today in many parts of the U.S. and the West.
I'm going to argue few people do it like you do, because you have that breadth and you have the staying power of doing this that... You bring great clarity.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Then that means it's working. You know.
No, it is.
Because you sit, you know, you know this as a scholar. You sit in your room banging away on the keyboard, and you press the publish button, and you wonder if anybody's actually reading it. So it's good to hear that it's being well received.
You know, I went into that part. I went in. So I spent a lifetime doing security. I was in 45 years with the Department of Defense. And so I first went into Korea with the military in 1982. So a few years before you went into China. And I've been back and forth, lived there in 15 years over a period of time. And then while I had great experiences in and around and through quite a bit of China, if I'm being honest, I haven't been back in 25 years.
Oh, it's unfortunate.
And so there's no doubt that we often wrongly, I think I was somewhere at one period of time, and that's how China has grown so much.
Yeah, and it's not a place that you can understand from books and from reading. You have to go. And I think one of the biggest tragedies of the modern era in the United States, and I was in Washington last summer and I heard it today, you know, this week from some of the interns. I talked to these young people who are interested in China, they're studying Chinese, they wanna pursue a career related to China.
Yeah.
And I say, why don't you go?
Yeah.
Just to understand the food, the people, the taste, the smells, just to walk around. Oh no, I can't go. It'll be bad for my security clearance, or it'll look bad. People will think I'm a communist, or all the... And that is heartbreaking to me.
It is.
Absolutely heartbreaking, because what it ends up happening is that we develop this very two-dimensional understanding of China.
Yeah.
And we've done this as a people decade after decade after decade. We did not understand in the run-up to World War II Germany's logic of power.
Sure.
The British, the Americans, the others did not understand it. We did not understand the Vietnamese logic of power. We did not understand who they were. We failed to learn the lesson. We did not understand it in Iraq. We did not understand it in Afghanistan. And we did not understand it with Osama bin Laden. And we are making the same mistake again with China. We are looking at this through our prism, our lens, and we're telling young people, don't go to China because it will look bad on your career. Instead, we should be encouraging them to go, learn the language, learn the culture, have a deeper understanding of how these people think and how they see the world, so that we can make policy and we can make knowledge that is more nuanced and refined than what we're doing today.
So here I was, 1999, and I'm traveling by car outside of Harbin, and I spoke to the driver and I said, you know what, let's stop by a retirement home. I want to speak to somebody there, director or whatever. So I won't go in and I say, this is who I am. I'd like to talk to you. And we're talking to the director and, you know, help me understand demographics and how those are changing here and how this affects the aging of society and spoke to residents there and stuff. And then we go a little bit further and I said, you know, I want to stop at a school and go in and I talk to I think it was eighth grade, English language class that's going on and talking to the teacher and to the students, and I'm afraid a lot of that isn't happening.
It isn't happening at all. And what I mean, I've been studying Chinese for 45 years. I still have Chinese lessons twice a week. I don't go to China as much as I used to, just because I'm traveling in other parts of the world. But I still feel very connected to the place and the people and the language. Many people will misinterpret that as somehow being, you know, soft on China and appeasement and things like that. The most ridiculous things you possibly can imagine. We have to understand how they see the world. And you cannot do that unless you are talking to people and talking to eighth graders and college students and retirees and understanding the dynamics. And then you go into China and you'll go to a place like Guizhou, which is the equivalent of going into Arkansas and getting out of the Beltway. People go to Beijing and to Shanghai and they'll go to a conference and they'll bounce out.
Yeah.
That's as garbage a way of analyzing a country as going to New York and saying, I've been to America, right? But we're not seeing that. So you're seeing across the United States now, interest in studying Chinese is falling.
Yes.
Chinese language programs are closing.
Yes.
Big programs like at Berkeley and Stanford are all contracting. I talked to a lot of the faculty. Now mostly the people who are studying Chinese are second generation, and they're doing it for their own cultural reasons. When I was coming up in the 80s, the State Department funded language programs in Russian and Chinese, because it was out of a national interest and a national security interest to have young people speak these languages.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore, and I think that's unfortunate.
Hmm. We're drawing close on time. I think I'm going to hit maybe a couple more questions, and we'll pull this to its close. But let's talk about middle power maneuvering.
Yeah.
And we've brought up a number of these countries. You know, countries like Indonesia, Vietnam, Fiji, I mean, they seek to avoid this binary alignment.
That's right.
And this intensifying U.S.-China rivalry that's going on. So what strategies are these nations using to preserve autonomy while maximizing their
So their equation is a both and, not an either or.
That's right.
And there's very few countries out there that are choosing an either or. Even the Philippines, which is firmly in the U.S. But you'll see that Philippine society is sharply divided on the relationship with China, along the lines of the Marcos clan and the Duterte clan. But that embedded in those two kind of divisions is a different outlook on China. So even the Philippines, which has chosen to have a very firm alignment with the United States, there's no consensus within the society as to whether or not that's the way. And it's very likely in the next power change that will shift again to the other way.
Yep.
These countries are in situations where they benefit more from deep U.S. engagement, deep Chinese engagement, deep Japanese engagement. And we're seeing in many ways the spread of Vietnam's bamboo diplomacy. And I love that framing that the Vietnamese have. You know, bamboo bends, but it doesn't break. And so the Vietnamese embarked on this strategy about 10 years ago under the former General Secretary Trom, the late General Secretary Trom, about forming partnerships, deep partnerships, high-level partnerships with lots of countries. And now Cambodia is following that same strategy. The Philippines is following that same strategy. They want to reduce dependence on one major power, economically and security. Yes. They want to have trade with more countries, and they want to mitigate the risks. And so I think you're going to see more countries do that. Countries like Panama, though, where they are so dependent on the United States, don't have that luxury. They have to accede to the great power demands because they're just simply in a box.
Dollar and they're
That's tough. It. They're choked off.
Yep.
A lot of countries, though, don't have that same type of dependency, and they do have some flexibility. One, I always point to Southeast Asia as a lesson and a great example for other developing countries, because few regions in the world have as much experience dealing with China than countries like Vietnam and Laos and others, given their geography. So they've managed these power relationships for a long time, and I think there's a lot that other regions of the world can learn from what they're doing in Southeast Asia.
Nah, spot on. The Global South, way ahead. Let's talk about this. So the Indo-Pacific, I mean, it is, in fact, a proving ground for how China engages with developing nations and for the emergence of these new norms and coalitions. So as we think towards the future, do you see the Global South agency shaping this world order or being shaped by it?
Huge. There is a reservoir of resentment towards the U.S.-led international order in many of these countries that for a long time have felt that they have not benefited anywhere near as much as they think they should. Yeah. And so when China comes along with this new parallel international governance architecture, BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Asian Investment Bank, the Global Development, Civilization, AI, and Security Initiatives, all these, this alphabet soup of new agencies, there's some, you know, ambivalence about signing up fully for it, but they like the idea of having an alternative to the current order. They don't like the idea that when Jay Powell wakes up one day in Washington, the Federal Reserve, and decides to adjust the U.S. interest rate, that it has a direct impact on their economies. They don't like the fact that, you know, that the commanding heights of international power are still in Washington and Brussels and other places like that. They want a bigger say. So that's why we see this growth of the BRICS and the growth of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the Chinese are fueling that because they want to have an alternative to the Western-led order. So I do see a lot more agency for developing countries in the future. In many respects, this is again going back to the beginning of our conversation, we are engaged in a battle of ideas. And if we can't bring better ideas to these countries, they're going to look somewhere else for someone who has more compelling visions.
Amazing. You know, before I let you go, I like to ask our guests to recommend a book to our audience. So maybe there's something you're reading.
So this is not an easy read, okay? So I'm reading Kevin Rudd's book, the current Australian ambassador to Washington, longtime China scholar, on Xi Jinping. And I think she is a very interesting character. And Rudd, you know, this is like his PhD thesis. It's tough to get through. There's no doubt. Not light reading, but essential reading to understand who he is, the context of why he's making decisions today and how he got there to make those decisions. It's a big, thick one, but I cannot recommend it enough. The other one that I recommend is Richard McGregor, who's a great Australian China scholar. He wrote about the Communist Party, and it's called The Party. And again, pairing Xi Jinping and The Party together, those two books, I think give you a very good understanding of contemporary China today.
Well, very nice. We'll put those in the show notes as well as your own program.
Wonderful.
We have benefited tremendously from your week with us.
No, I've learned a lot more than I shared. I learned a lot more than I shared.
I don't know that's true, but again, thank you much. I look forward to keeping this relationship, this contact
Likewise.
Together. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. As we conclude today's dialogue, we're reminded that China's engagement in the global South is about more than loans and infrastructure. It's about influence, leverage, and evolving choices of sovereign states. Across the Indo-Pacific South, nations are not merely recipients of power, but shapers of it, negotiating agency, asserting identity, recalibrating partnerships in real time. These conversations shape security. Join us again for more insights from the region. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for being a part of this important dialogue. I'm James Minnick. Aloha oi.
As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.